This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by RLJ Entertainment. Coming soon from RLJ is, drumroll please, All the Creatures Were Stirring, co-directed by Shockwaves' very own Rebecca McKendry. In the film, a young couple struggling through their first date on Christmas Eve end up in a spooky theater where they're shown several bizarre and twisted Christmas tales, all featuring scenes of holiday horror. All the Creatures Were Stirring stars Constance Wu, Jonathan Kite, Amanda Fuller, Jocelyn Donahue, Graham Skipper, Ashley Clements, Megan Duffy, and our Kane. You can find the film on Redbox now. It will be coming to VOD and Walmart on December 4th and hits Shudder on December 13th.
Proud of you, Becca. All right, tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. Some call it the Netflix of horror, but plain and simple, it's the best streaming outlet to get scary, weird, macabre, and great genre cinema. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest-growing, human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. To try Shudder for free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use promo code WAVES.
And welcome to episode 124 of Shockwaves. Woo! I am one of your hosts, Rob G.
Thank God it's November because we were slacking October.
You think so, Elric?
Slacked so hard.
Elric Kane, my co-host.
Hi. From Knoxville. I was there last week.
Sure.
That was a live show that you listened to on Thanksgiving.
I think that's really lazy that you went to Knoxville to
all
do
the way
episode,
to do a live show by myself. Yeah,
why are you lazy?
I don't know why we're lazy.
Ryan Turek, hi.
Laziest motherfucker on the web. Ryan Turek.
Speaking of lazy, I mean, Rebecca is promoting a movie that she just finished and is all over the place, and she didn't even show up for the show.
I know.
I mean, really? Come on.
Getting press in EW and shooting a movie while pregnant?
Yeah, she can do that, but she can't show up to a podcast. You know,
right?
The fine print, guys.
I don't know.
This is a free show. I mean, we are slacking, apparently. Yeah. Anyways.
But anyways, I wanted to say I'm very proud of Becca for All the Creatures Were Stirring. It's a very fun anthology film, and, you know, and to see her and Dave get this off the ground with a great cast, I'm elated. So
perfect for the season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I always say, like, look, if you have any doubts about – I mean, look, it's difficult to make any movie, but I'm always inspired by Becca because she's a mom of two. Mm-hmm. She's married. She has a job. She teaches courses. She does these things. And she makes no excuses for why she can't make films. Like, on the weekends, she's either doing shorts.
Yep.
And she basically made this as if it was several shorts.
Yeah.
And finished a feature that's coming out everywhere. And so – Not to say, like, everyone always has an excuse for why you can't do it. I don't want to hear it because I literally have seen Becca do it, and it's a lot of hard work. If you're willing to do it, you can make something happen.
Yeah. Yeah, so, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the thing is I've known Becca for, I mean, over 10 years now, and to watch her grow as...
Did you know her when she was in New York?
I knew her when she was – I didn't know her,
but you knew of
in,
her
in New York, but I knew her, you know, when she was Mistress Becca and all that stuff. So Becca's like a sister to me, and I give her a lot of shit on air and off the air. And but, you know, it's all to mask that I'm just really proud of seeing the kind of journey she has taken from someone who has been on the ground working hard at Fangoria to growing into her own filmmaker.
I don't know if we talked about this, but I was giving her – you guys weren't there, but I was giving her shit at Trivia the other month.
Oh, yeah.
And I was hosting, and I was like doing what exactly what I do on the show as a joke, and there was a lot of people who were like new to trivia and had no idea. And there was a group of people who were actually coming up concerned afterwards to her because they just thought I was a total asshole. And I was, and I realized in that moment, that was actually a good learning moment. I was like, oh yeah, not everyone listens to Shockwaves. Like if you knew us, I feel the same way. We've known each other forever.
I did see, you know, it was funny.
Interesting.
I did see like a comment somewhere. I forgot where it was, but it was like, Ryan always gives Becca shit and I don't like that. No, no, no. It's like, Becca's like a sister. Like, yeah, I mean, like the thing is what you're listening to is four personalities who have all known each other for a very, very long time. Rob is like my brother. You have known, you know.
I'm like your stepfather.
You're like my weird uncle.
Did weird shit.
But no, we all.
You're the Terry O'Quinn of the
we all hang out on air and off air, you know, when we see each other often. And what you're hearing is just our normal banter, so.
Yeah, yeah. But it was pretty funny to me because I didn't pick up on it straight away. And then I started seeing the crowd turn and go, oh, they don't actually know who I am. And they don't know who they don't know this. And now they're concerned for her. That's okay.
That crowd was like, man, Australians are assholes.
Yeah, yeah. Which they are. Which they are. So I'm happy to keep going with that. As a New Zealand, I'll undermine them. But it is a bummer that she's not here. But then next week, we are going to actually talk a little bit about that movie with her. And
that's right.
People.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's kind of cool. So,
yeah, looking ahead, we should just, you know, from now until the end of the year, we've probably got two more episodes left. We're going to be doing one that's All the Creatures Were Stirring centric and have a couple guests on. And then the episode after that, we'll be doing our year-end recap. And then we're going to take a little break. But 2019 is shaping up to look really awesome.
I said we had to have a meeting about this. You guys are planning it without me. I said I wanted a meeting. Let's have a sit down.
We talked a little bit about it.
But we've got some really great guests for you lined up, and we're very excited to head into the new year with us.
So we won't be slacking, is what you're saying.
Yeah, we're not slacking.
And remember to rate and review us on iTunes if you like the show.
We're doing a lot of laundry right now.
A lot of this is airing
some laundry. Anyways, how was Thanksgiving?
Man, I've already forgotten about
it. Pretty good. I drove to Arizona to see my folks, and I stopped by the Film Bar in Phoenix, Arizona, which I'll give them a plug. We've talked about them in the past, but they're like it's a really cool little theater. It's part bar, part theater, and the program there is fantastic. The show, I think the week that I was there, they were showing Suspiria, and they're about to show the new, what's the Matt Dillon?
House That Jack Built.
That was coming up. It's probably playing there right now. And, I met up with Andrea and her husband, Roger, who, she's the programmer there. And they just do, like, cool stuff. And it's like, one of the things I've learned by kind of working on the independent side of distribution is that there's places like this all over the country. Like, it's not just AMC and these giant theaters. And mind you, I love going to those. But there are these cool little quirky theaters that have, you know, whether it's a coffee house and a screen or a bar and a screen. And I love that, man. I hope they keep growing and that there's more things like this. But if you're ever in Phoenix, even if you don't go to see a movie, just drop by and have a drink. We just had drinks there, and they were projecting trailers on the wall the whole time. And it was like Toxic Avenger just so many. It's just a great environment.
It's the communal thing will never die.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that could keep cinema alive forever is that the communal nature of it is the best part about it. And if you can keep, places can keep that going, then the art form can keep going. I do worry that if ever that part went away, I just don't know. It would keep going. There'd still be movies and TV, but it gets condensed to something else. Like you see it on Netflix right now. I'm seeing that model. Obviously, there's a lot of benefits. I'm also seeing it change some of the movies. Some of them are getting bloated. Some of them don't look like they've gone through the process enough to even exist. They're just quickly up on a screen. And it's actually putting me off pushing play, including one I saw this week, because they're so long.
Yeah, no, it's hard. I mean, that was the only other advantage of having a little bit of a break is like I finally got to finish The Haunting of Hill House, which is a show I wanted to watch. I'm just so overwhelmed by the amount of content that's coming at us, especially on Netflix. And it's cool that this stuff exists, but like when it comes to its genre stuff, I mean, there's a new Coen Brothers movie I haven't watched yet.
I know, and I didn't even know about it till it popped up, and I was like, how do I not know a new Coen Brothers movie?
But I feel like I was thinking about this over the weekend because somebody else had brought it up, and I saw some comments in the Shockwaves group. I feel like going to Netflix or going to Shudder or anything like that is just now even though it's not me saying this, is terrible, but it's the equivalent of going into a video store and going, oh my gosh, there's all this new stuff that just came out. And I gotta, now I gotta figure out when can I rent this movie? Well, I can't rent this movie this week, but I will have to make a choice.
I think the difference in Shudder really stands out for me is because it's already curated and it's already hitting its target. So by me going to Shudder, it's because I already want what's on Shudder. Yeah. Like, that's what's genius about Shudder, and Filmstruck was of RIP as of probably the airing of this, I think, was great in that same way. The difference is Netflix isn't, and Netflix is just kind of a Wild West random assortment. But it's still gone. This isn't a diss. There's a lot of great stuff that comes to Netflix. I've just been noticing lately that a lot, the way it just pops up and a lot of things just feel like the form of what a movie is sometimes getting a little misshapen or bloated.
Yeah.
But whatever, you know, it's again, this will go away.
To me, it's about trying to find this stuff that you hear about. It's like, oh, Buster Scruggs. Okay, cool. I definitely want to see it. And when I went onto Netflix the morning that it popped up and I wanted to add it to my queue, I had to go digging into the search function to go find it.
That's the bummer part.
And that's the bummer part. I mean, Netflix will catch up to you and go, okay, you know, by like probably 10 a.m., they probably had it in their rotation on their carousel and you were able to find it easily. But when I was there at that moment, it was like going into a video store and not seeing it on the new release shelf, but you had to go like behind the counter and go, hey, where's this movie you're supposed to put out? It's weird.
I'll be curious when they get to Scorsese's big one, because that cost him like a couple $100 million.
Oh, I'm sure.
It has to do theatrical for a while. I mean, it has to. Like, you can't imagine them just not going theatrical initially.
Yeah, no, I think they probably will.
It'll be interesting. It's an interesting model.
And speaking of, you mentioned Shudder and Thanksgiving. Did anyone get to watch Joe Bob?
Yeah, that's on my...
I only watched a little bit, but what was that all about?
Did you watch the beginning?
I watched the beginning and kind of his lead into the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
And then I looked at what they curated for
that. And
that was
just classic.
Yeah.
That was classic. Did you watch any of it?
Spinning Wheel for me. I think it was my Hulu was the problem. I don't think it was actually them, but it just kept spinning and wouldn't load.
Oh, really?
So I gave up and I thought I'll watch it the recorded version.
Yeah, I'm watching it now that it's been uploaded as a show.
Yeah, because I missed the first go around when Joe Bob was playing it live. I just wanted the experience of doing it live, so we made sure that we cooked and everybody was seated for that.
Yeah.
And Joe Bob began with like this terrific history of America that was just like a dissertation on bigotry, which was amazing. But what was great about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was it was a incredibly beautiful, heartfelt tribute to not just the movie, but to Tobe Hooper himself. And so what you would find yourself doing is wanting to you watch Texas Chainsaw and you're like, okay, come on, let's get through the movie so we can get to the next Joe Bob segment. Because Joe, he would just, you know, pontificate about all of you know, what made the movie great and you know, just talk about Toby. And then when he was kind of winding down and finishing a thought, he'd be like, oh, one more thing. And he would go on for another five minutes.
Yeah, cool.
But he was doing that a lot more than often, you know, more often than not, and which is great. So we sat through that, and then we did Hills Have Eyes. Most of our guests who were visiting had gone. So we finished watching Hills Have Eyes, and that concluded with a terrific interview with Michael Berryman. It was really, really cool. It was talking about you know, his early career, and you know, Joe Bob just kind of got personal and under the hood of, you know, who Michael was, and working with Wes Craven and working with The Hills Have Eyes, which was a lot of fun. Then he did Takeshi Miike's Dead or Alive.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I wasn't expecting that to be one of the films.
Yeah, I've never seen it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to sit through this one because I heard the last one was obviously going to be Blood Rage.
Yeah.
So I was kind of sitting through it, and it was about, I think, like 11:30. And I was like, well, I could probably survive. And then I conked out. And when I woke up the next morning, I said, oh, when all the episodes were loaded up, I said, oh, how long was Dead or Alive? How much longer did I have to sit through? It was 150 minutes.
Oh, man.
So it was a whole choice. I wonder why they chose. Did he say why he chose it at the start?
I kind of half listened, but yeah. But
Blood Rage is what everyone wants.
But Blood Rage,
give them the Blood Rage,
delivered the fucking goods.
Yeah, man, that movie rules.
That movie is incredible. And it was the second time, I think it was my second or third time seeing that film.
Did he have a lot of insights into that one?
He did. He did. He had a lot of factoids about it. And then Louise Lasser, a lot about her, which was great. And then he compares Lena Dunham as the Louise Lasser of every time. I was like, oh my God. He's like, if you need a girl to like have a crazy breakdown on screen, you can't get better than her.
That's
and,
awesome.
And then he was like, and then he was charting Luis's mental breakdown in Blood Rage. He's like, and here she is cleaning the house, and then here she is making a phone call to a phone operator and just telling him about her pie.
Yeah, it's a weird subplot to that story.
So
her,
good.
Her story, yeah.
So wow.
Good. But it was awesome, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing what they do with Christmas, because he's coming back for
Christmas
special.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So. Yeah. No, that should be funny. I'm going to catch up on those, but I did start with the Chainsaw one. I don't know. Elric, you want to lead
I'm
us
curious,
up with films?
I'm curious which ones. Yeah, I saw a bunch. I'm doing my last – I do this every year around now. I do my final slog for any outsiders that might make my 10.
Right.
I take my 10 very seriously. I do want to try to get some of the smaller ones.
So I appreciate that down. Because you messaged me being like, hey, this is probably not going to be in your top 10, so you can hold on.
Yeah, and Becca, there was one that Becca was put off by seeing, and then there was one that I think she did watch because of me this weekend that she's not here, unfortunately, that she liked as well. So I'll mention that one.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised. I'll start with Cam. Did everyone see Cam yet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw Cam over the weekend, yeah.
Oh, you saw it over the weekend?
It's
yes.
A Blumhouse movie, isn't it?
It is, but honestly, yes. And it was another exec who handled it, and I just kind of – I read the script, and then I just wanted myself to be surprised at the end of the day. So, yeah.
Sure, let's talk about Cam.
Yeah, okay. you're looking straight. I liked Cam. I thought it was interesting. I'd read a little. I didn't know anything about it. I'd read the thing about it being written by an ex-sex industry worker who'd you know, they'd written the script. So the world of the film I thought was really interesting.
Okay.
I was really pulled in that. It definitely kind of goes – once it becomes kind of a – I don't want to spoil things, but it becomes kind of a doppelganger type of story. It goes, you know, obviously in the treads the territory of a David Lynch type thing, but not as – obviously not as effectively, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I will say as a horror movie – it is a horror movie, but that wasn't the part that interested me about this movie. It was really the world that she's in. The performance is fantastic. There's a lot of really interesting moments, but it never as a horror movie really – and I know that might just sound like bullshit, like what's a horror movie? But I was never really that – the doppelganger stuff and kind of the conclusion wasn't the part that got me into this movie. I think it's a really good movie. I don't know if I love the movie and because I see a lot of love for it, and I'm glad there is a lot of love for it online because it's an interesting movie. Yeah, so as a horror movie, I don't want to say underwhelmed because that's not the right way to put it. Just I didn't really view – I viewed it more like a Black Mirror thing,
yeah.
Which it works
yeah.
as one of those. Mm-hmm. But the performance is stellar, and I haven't quite seen that world yet of the Cam stuff. The Cam stuff. Of it. I kind of think I know where he's going with his look right now.
I'm smirking. I saw a lot of love for this movie, and so I decided to watch it. And I made it like 15 minutes, and this is just not for me. I don't understand that world. I don't. Basically, I'm at the point. I am old man Rob G decided. I don't care enough. Yeah. And then also the thing that was interesting is I thought the opening sequence. It's very stylized because you're going into this world of somebody who makes a living as a cam girl.
Yeah.
But then in the opening scene has kind of like a horror set piece that you're like, oh, okay, this is interesting. But then, like you said, the horror, there's no like, so basically it's more about identity yeah. and likes and things and like, I'm very scared.
Which is also what held Rob G back on Tragedy Girls.
No, I was about to say that it was the same.
Say,
it was the same.
It's exactly why that's the same movie I thought of. It's like, I don't like this girl. Like this isn't, she's not scared for her life. She's scared for her popularity. And it's like, well,
but you didn't finish the movie or you didn't?
No, I didn't finish it. No,
stakes do get raised.
I would consider going back, but honestly, again, it's like there's so much content and things
out
there.
The problem you were going to have just now, I thought what you were intimating was that it's actually got quite a lot of similarities, not in a legal sense, but just structurally to Imitation Girl in terms of, because Imitation Girl is doppelgangers and somebody who was in sex industry.
I never drew that parallel.
Okay. Yeah, there's a little bit. I mean, different worlds.
Not the same type of movie at all. No, I had a tough time getting into it, and I was like, this isn't for me. And you know what? That's okay. If a movie's not for you, you should be able – I mean, there's a brand new Orson Welles movie on Netflix.
Well, this is the thing with Netflix.
15 minutes into Cam, and I'm like, what am I doing with my life?
Yeah, but if you had rented that at Blockbuster, you would have finished it. That's the difference, guys, about
it
streaming.
It is the difference.
He would have finished that movie, and he would have gotten his money worth.
Yeah.
So, but no, I think it will probably, you know, just – from right now, it's probably narrowly missed my 10, but it is definitely worth watching. I think I think Becca liked it a lot. We'll get from her.
I thought she posted her review.
Yeah,
I saw
that. I definitely think it's interesting, and I think it's very now. I think a lot of movies that try to make something on now fail pretty badly because the technology stuff is usually really cheesy. Yeah. I didn't think that about this one. I think the tech stuff was the interesting. The stalker angles are interesting too because definitely the fun part about the movie is in the first like 20 minutes, I'm definitely, oh, this is definitely a stalker movie. This is definitely going to be a stalker movie. Right. And when it plays, it changes that. Yeah. It's fun in that
sense. Takes different turns.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can't weigh in on that because
– No, I liked it? With the fresh eyes, I did. I did like it. Yeah. I kind of wanted a little bit more – I felt the third act was a little bit too ambiguous for my taste, you know. But I thought that Danny and the team did a very good job, you know, in terms of escalating that sense of dread. There's one moment where I actually went, "Oh God," you know, because she was meeting someone in public, and it's very much about being like an online or you know an online persona, and then meeting your public for the first time or meeting someone who could be stalked. You know,
it's kind of like going to Texas and having somebody touch you on your face. It can be a little frightening.
Cam part two, Elric's story.
Yeah, Meister.
Oh no, Cam part two, touch my face.
Touch my face. Yeah, it could do well.
Wow.
But yeah, so not necessarily approved by the Shockwaves Hall, but you know, still worth your time.
Yeah. Not at all. Let me bring up my IMDb because I need to talk to you guys about a little movie that's called – it's called Mind Ripper. Let's be honest. That's the name of this movie. However, Code Red put out a Blu-ray and because it was produced by Wes Craven and written by his son Jonathan Craven and released overseas as The Hills Have Eyes 3 Mind Ripper.
I've never watched this. Let me see the back.
Yeah, take a look at this.
I mean, I know Mind Ripper. I just have never watched this.
Check out that bald dude with a thing coming out of his mouth.
And Lance Henriksen.
This is wonderful because I had Steve Scarlatta and Josh Miller come over because, of course, they're like, Hills Have Eyes 3. We need to see this. So it stars Lance Henriksen as one of the leads. His daughter is played by Natasha Gregson-Wagner, who I love.
Lost Highway.
His son, and this is Giovanna Rigsby, in one of his early roles.
Rubisi.
Yeah, this is 95. So if you can remember what the horror landscape was like in 95, and basically it, from what I understand from the ever reliable Wikipedia, this started out as a Hills Have Eyes sequel and then morphed into a completely other idea project. So there's no real connection other than there are hills in it.
what more do you need, Rob?
Have eyes?
They do not have eyes, but what they have is – so basically there's a facility that's in the middle of – a testing facility in the middle of these desert in this hills that Lance Henriksen works with this team, and they're trying this experimental drug to revive dead – soldiers, dead corpses. So it's got a little reanimator touch in there, or Universal Soldier, whatever you want to do. So they have one test subject there, and then because of the morality of it all, Lance Henriksen quits. He's like, I can't be a part of this, etc. He's about to go on vacation with his family, including his daughter's boyfriend, who not only is a terrible actor, but could be the worst cinematic boyfriend in 90s horror history.
Whoa, that's a
He's kind of constantly talking about banging or trying to sleep with Natasha in front of Lance Henriksen. And I'm like, if Lance Henriksen was your girlfriend's dad, I would not be talking inappropriately about her in front of him. But we were laughing because we were like, God, I hope he meets a horrible death because he's definitely deserving it. And then what's his name? The son, Giovanna.
Giovanna Ribisi.
Yes, thank you. He is totally mid-90s, kind of like he's always got his headphones on. He's angry at his dad. he's very of that moment, you know, just listening to hard rock music and like, I don't want to go on this family vacation with you guys, especially you, Dad. You're always working. So it's pretty amazing in that regard. But what happens is one of the test subjects who looks like he's from a hair metal band, comes back alive. He's like, I called him Mutant Fabio, because he's running around the facility, and then it becomes kind of almost like an Aliens ripoff where they're just trying to like hide from this one guy that has like, stuff coming out of his mouth, like this little thing, and then he loses all his hair, and so he basically becomes this bald mutant guy right here.
And he is the eponymous Mind Ripper?
He is the Mind Ripper. He sticks this thing out of his... they don't call him that, but what happens is this thing comes out of his mouth with like a, it's almost like it comes out of his tongue. It's like a spike that comes out of his tongue and then he like shoves it through your eyeball or part of, We were like, oh, he's ripping the mines. Oh, I okay. see it now.
Oh, so it's like Jeff Combs and
yes.
From Beyond.
Yeah, from Beyond. And so, I mean, well, there's a review from Fangoria on the back that says atmosphere and genuine fear. I strongly disagree with both of those descriptions.
All those people no longer work for Fango anyway, so at this point, I'm sure. So.
But let me tell you, I had a lot of fun with it. And actually, it was good with a group environment. And it's funny because Code Red tends to be on the expensive side, but I guess they're not moving a lot of these. This was $9.99, and that's why I was like, oh, $10 gamble to fill in that slot in my collection for Hills Have Eyes. So now, if you want, there are 5 Hills Have Eyes movies, and you could own 3 if you go to RoninFlix.com. I strongly recommend Mind Ripper. It's a fun mid-90s kind of time.
And 88 Films Overseas did a limited edition.
Actually, just better, just better to cover, show your but commitment. It's the same cover.
Oh, and just so you know, it's I forgot to look it up, but it was I believe it ended up being a made for HBO.
Was it?
It never played in theaters. This was and it wasn't a direct-to-video either. It was a cable movie. Hmm. And so it has that cable movie mid-90s feel to it. But I still had a lot of fun with it.
I remember seeing the ad for it at Tower Video. No, Kim's Video.
Really?
One afternoon,
Mind Ripper.
Because I used to work over at the comic book shop, St. Mark's Comics. And I would want to go across and go pick up some VHS tapes. And I remember seeing Mind Ripper. And I was like, what's up with that dude? And the guy was like, I don't know, man, but they call that The Hills Have Eyes 3. And I was like, oh.
Yeah. Now I'm intrigued. So yeah, I can't waste time on Cam, but I will waste 98 minutes on The Hills Have Eyes 3 Mind Ripper. So there you go.
That puts it in context.
Walking contradiction.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's good.
What did I see? Oh, I also watched this on Thanksgiving Day. I revisited I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Okay.
From 1997, Jim Gillespie.
Oh, yeah.
You know what? I know you guys are both giving me looks right now.
I like it, man. I
have
had
a no
soft
problem
spot.
Watching Jennifer Love Hewitt when I was that younger.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it since. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I mean, like when I was a film student checking this out in 97, and I was swept up in the Scream craze. Yep. I fought for this movie. I went into the school the next day and was like, guys, you got to see I Know What You Did Last Summer. Great set pieces.
Yeah.
Really scary. Da, da, da. You know, Kevin Williamson wrote it. So I was back in my boy. Now, as an older man, it's still incredibly entertaining. And it's of its time, and I dig that. The movie fucking opens with Typo Negative, and you're like, yeah man, Summer Breeze, play that shit. Although, now I'm watching it going, man, why didn't they let the music dominate? Because they got the waves and the mix sound sounds weird right now. But story-wise, I'm still in it. I like living with these characters. I like the stakes that are at play. I loved watching all, these four, budding teenagers all excited about life and talking about where they were going to go on with each other's, after high school, and then seeing how disheveled and wrecked their lives. I mean, literally when they cut to Jennifer Love Hewitt in college and the girl's like, come on, you need to get your sassy pants out of bed. And then they cut Jennifer Love Hewitt turns around. And her bangs are like ratty. It's like, oh shit,
she's
man.
Got dark eyes.
Dark eyes.
The gothic
look. Pale, ratty bangs. So all of that stuff is fun. It's when the story starts to get into lean into the investigative side.
Yeah.
When they start delving into, who they might have killed and this poor boy and what his backstory is and why is Anne Heche living in the backwoods wearing a nightgown and doing whatever Anne Heche does in the backwoods.
Blame the Psycho remake.
Yeah.
That's what did it. How's the fisherman slasher? The fisherman, I thought that was pretty cool.
It is cool. I mean, the fisherman slasher is still pretty rad. It's just you wish, that the death blows were bigger and bloodier. But in terms of out of that post-Scream era, I'll still fight for I Know What You Did Last Summer. I still think it's one of the better ones that came out.
Not part two. I remember part two in theaters.
Oh,
just
man.
Going, damn, two is,
yeah.
Not good, man.
The last time I revisited this was a couple years ago, but I did a double feature of one and two back-to-back. And one was like, all right, that's kind of fun. It's of its time period. I had a blast seeing that when it came out because, again, horror was kind of, at least theatrical horror in that period of the 90s, was kind of nothing was really happening, and then Scream came along.
Yeah.
And Scream was like a slow burn because it wasn't like a big hit right away. It was like, oh my God, everyone started talking about it. And then I saw an advanced screening of I Know What You Did Last Summer in New York City, I think at NYU, And were you there?
Whoa.
All right, well, hold on a second. Let's see if we, okay.
This was on, no, it wasn't NYU. It was one of the, it was like next to St. Mark's. It was like Fort, there was a theater. It was like a multiplex.
I think so.
And they were giving away free t-shirts.
Maybe.
And
here's how you'll know if you were there, because I distinctly remember there's a joke, not a joke, but there's a piece of dialogue in the beginning when they're at the beach and I think it's Jennifer Love Hewitt, or maybe it's him. I can't remember exactly, but basically they make a reference to, like, well, you're just going to move to New York and go to NYU and, like, hook up with some godly ways. And the whole audience went, yeah. And, like, you know, New York audience just burst into applause, like, yeah, that's
us.
I remember waiting to see this movie because I knew Jeff Combs was going to be in it. And I was so excited.
That's the sequel.
And I was so excited about it because I was like, oh, cool, finally Jeff. And then I go and he's in, like, one scene as the fucking clerk or something. And I was like, what? These people don't love horror.
What I love about the sequel is, like, because everyone's like, man, I hate that Jamaican guy. He's so stupid. And then reminding people 2 years later, like, that's Jack Black, right? Like, what? Yeah. No. But yeah, 2 is pretty bad.
We might have been at the same screening, man.
I know. How funny is that?
That's pretty wild.
Yeah,
that was, you know, it, by then, kind of like the Scream fad had taken hold. And I know we did last summer, like, it did really well.
Yeah.
Like it made like over 100 million
worldwide. That was the one-two punch. Scream, I know, and then all of a sudden I was like, all right, Urban Legends.
Well, Scream, I know, and then Scream 2 that Christmas or holiday season, it was like, holy crap. But
Do you guys I lump in, even though it's not a slasher, but because it felt like those movies, The Craft, I always feel like it's really good, but I felt like all those movies had the same sheen.
I felt like The Craft was on the periphery because that was
preceded all of that. Yeah. Maybe it set the bar a little bit for Scream, but they all do feel the sheen of those movies and the use of soundtracks to those movies.
Oh yeah, well then because I remember it was like The Faculty was in that world, but it wasn't a slasher.
Well, The Faculty,
but it still felt like,
and that had a different type of vibe because of the humor, the way it
teaching Mrs.
Story.
Tingle. Remember
that one was
originally was called Killing Mrs. Tingle.
Yeah. No, I was excited to see that.
The Faculty was like the pinnacle of all that was clean and. You know, super fashionable and all. I mean, like, there was music going nonstop. And then I remember, like, weren't they all Abercrombie models? Didn't Abercrombie do like a tie in with the Faculty?
Probably,
cast,
maybe.
And
but there was good people
stuff.
in that movie.
Yeah.
And then what's the one where they're the Texas one where the girl turns out to be like Android? What's the with Katie Holmes? What's that one called?
Disturbing Behavior.
So that
I kind of like that.
And I like that one. I thought that one was actually fun. But it's like funny how all these kind of somebody has to just look at that as a group. I mean, I know there's books on 90s.
Oh, well, it was Alexander West's. Yeah, her book is fantastic. In fact, you have to read the I Know What You Did Last Summer, I Still Know What You Did Last Summer chapter, because when I got done with that, I was like, ah, damn it, I need to revisit I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. Because she had some really great points that she brought up, and it made me curious to go back and revisit it. Then they made a third one, I'll always know.
Yeah.
Did they? But not with Jennifer Love Hewitt.
She's not in it. And they even recast The Fisherman with Don Shanks, Michael Myers, and Halloween 5.
That's right. Yeah.
And then the end of this whole movement, if this is a movement, which I love that this episode's now about this movement, is definitely Cherry Falls. Like Cherry, which
well,
I think
never,
is one of the
That never got released, though.
But well,
really?
Back in the day,
and
it came
I loved
out
it.
VHS when I was in New Zealand. But I remember going, at the time, I thought that one was super weird. But watching it again recently with you, I actually, or whoever it was, on Blu-ray, I actually really enjoyed it because it's bonkers. It's different from the rest.
I love it.
But that one definitely felt like the end of that.
That was the end of that cycle.
You know, because after that,
then
I was
we
like,
were, that would, then we were in post-Columbine where all of a sudden everybody was like a little more conscious of what, teens dying, we can't do that in horror anymore. Yeah. It's like, but you know. Yeah. So, yeah,
good
very interesting.
Finding anything else to talk about in horror.
Well, the best thing, I can lend you the Blu-ray of I Still Know because I have the double feature, but the best thing to come out of it is Jennifer Love Hewitt's music video for How Do I Deal?
Oh, yes.
You remember that?
Uh-huh. So. I do remember that.
I don't, but I'll be watching it on a break. I saw a couple Island movies. A big fan of the Island movies.
All right.
So I did a couple. One I thought was really awesome and one I was underwhelmed with, unfortunately. The one that I thought was awesome is The Overlord. I thought Overlord was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Saw it in theater before because I knew I'd probably leave soon. Especially the first half I thought was badass as a war film, and the way it opens on a plane and the guy's just flying, it's freaking great.
It
really grabs you by the lapels, throws you into the mix. I felt like the last act, and I won't do any spoilers in case you haven't seen it yet, but it's a really fun movie. I feel like it could have gone even more crazy with the horror because it kind of sells itself like it's going to be holy shit, this is going to create crazy.
Yeah.
It kind of creates a villain that I wouldn't have. I think villains who talk and stuff in movies like this are always a negative when you could just go crazy horror shit could be happening and mutants and set pieces. That's kind of what I want to watch at an end.
Well, he definitely served his purpose for the first half.
Exactly.
You know, he was a terrific villain in a very archetypal World War II, even war movie villain. Yeah. But yeah, they transition him into something else.
And it ends a little safe, a horror. You know, it goes a little safely, I think, with the horror. But it's really fun, and that's definitely one of the more fun horrors. And then the one I thought I would freaking love, and one of the movies I most was excited to see, except for its running time, which is The Apostle on Netflix, Gareth Evans. So, yeah. I mean, I've liked everything he's made. I was deeply, deeply underwhelmed by this movie to the point where like three quarters of the way I was like, okay, I could keep watching. I mean, again, it felt like part of this Netflix thing where it was 2 hours and
– It's like 2:20.
2:20 or something.
That's honestly what scared me off from
– And it's everything about it I like. It's meant to be Wicker Man-esque. It's got Dan Stevens in the lead. Yeah. I'm in. The director's a fantastic director. It just feels bloated and unnecessarily long. I mean, I could have – there's nothing in that movie that couldn't have had a whole hour easily, not even like difficultly, just easily removed. And so there's just saying, and also to be perfectly honest, for me, the set action pieces in that weren't that interesting. So I was like, the guy made The Raid, so I'm not going to be dissing on him. That's one of the greatest action pieces ever filmed, you know? So I don't know. It just wasn't for me.
But did you go in expecting big action set pieces?
No. I'm just saying when there were, I found the actual way they were a little underwhelmed, couple of fights. Also just was not interested in the horror by the time it came. It's interesting. It's a guy going to an island to try to get a sister back. He's a fuck up who's kind of been on heroin. I think maybe this happens, I'm noticing, with a lot of movies that are too long. At a certain point in the narrative forgets that that's the lead character and then starts going to other characters for a while and then comes back to its lead character, and by that time you're kind of out of the movie. And I've noticed with a lot of movies, it makes sense because now you've left the lead character for 30 minutes, returned to them, and I've just seen it in a few films lately and it takes me out. And so I just felt I didn't really connect to anything. But I'm sure some people are going to love this one. And I'm excited that he made a film. The Wicker Man thing, the best scenes are kind of a flashback to me. Like, there's a couple flashbacks that are the most exciting visually. And so, I was definitely underwhelmed on it, unfortunately. Even though I think he's a huge talent and, whatever he makes next, I would watch.
Yeah.
So those were my two island movies.
Wow. Cool. The only other thing I saw that I wanted to talk about was... our friend Mick Carroll sent us a bunch of Blu-rays from...
Well, I only got one.
I got a couple.
All that matters is
I had Next of Kin, I had Next of Kin.
Get Razorback?
I also have Razorback.
Oh, yes. Nice.
I had never seen Razorback.
It's badass, dude.
But this Blu-ray is beautiful and pristine and wonderful. And wow, quite a movie about a giant...
Razorback.
Boar?
Version of a boar. When it destroys a whole freaking house and you're like, holy
That's
shit.
Actually... I think I Instagrammed that because I thought it was just so funny. It might even be in the menu at the beginning.
And then the title card comes on.
Yeah.
It's
pretty wild.
The scene gets in there.
But also a very unexpected, they kind of, basically it's Jaws, but with a giant boar in the Australian?
Outback.
Yeah. And they set up a girl that you think is the lead character, and then something really awful happens to her, and they're like, oh, I didn't expect that. That's kind of awful. Mm-hmm. because there's locals that are about to violate her in a terrible way. And you're thinking like, oh, I hope the boar shows up and takes these guys out. And it just turns out it just gets worse. And you're like, oh, shit, that's what horror movies are. Just bad to worse. And then her, her husband comes looking for her because obviously she goes missing. And then that's where and then there's another character who basically in the opening sequence, there's a guy who first meets the Razorback who steals his grandson. And we're talking a baby. And so I was like, wow, a giant boar movie that has the balls to kill a baby in the opening scene
You haven't seen that since Deadly Eyes.
Yeah.
Another great show. Great double feature.
I do love that one. Yeah, yeah.
Great double feature.
And
this has a direct tie-in to Howling 3, The Marsupials. A direct connection.
What's the direct?
I just like to believe that the boar could enter. It would be amazing if those two were connected.
And I'm pretty sure this was covered in Not Quite Hollywood, which.
Definitely.
Yeah, there's so many films in that documentary that I'm like, oh,
I got to revisit it now, actually, because I'd forgotten Next of Kin was in there. I didn't remember that being mentioned in that movie, so.
Yeah. Razorback on Blu-ray, and that is Umbrella, the company that's been doing a lot of kick-ass movies. So
I like the cover, too.
Yeah, cover's rad, and there's an alternate cover reverse when you open it.
Wait, and the important part, I hope I'm not wrong on this, is I think it's directed by Russell Mulcahy.
Russell Mulcahy, yeah,
so 100%. This is, Mr. Highlander, and he's a really solid director.
Is this his first? Because this is 1984.
I would have thought so.
So I'm pretty sure
this is what got him the gig for Highlander.
Yeah, this is his debut feature.
Because it's very muscular, the direction. It's just like everything feels connected and it just keeps moving. It's for a movie called Razorback, it's really well made.
Yeah, it's his first feature, and then before this he'd done like a ton of music videos for like Elton John and Duran Duran and stuff like that.
How about NXS?
Okay.
I bet there's one. It was worth a gamble.
What I like about Razorback is how he depicts the boar, because there's a lot of great moments where, you know, he's like looking through binoculars and he's hunting the boar and he's over by like a watering hole or something like that. And you see all these pigs standing around the watering hole, and then like the camera pans past this one giant shape, and then it kind of sits back.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, there he is.
Yeah.
And it's just like, just chilling out.
Well, and the way he dominates all the other pigs. And
he dominates all the other pigs. Yeah. No, it's really cool. It looks realistic.
I wonder if they'll have an American release at any point.
You know what? I mean, maybe. But I mean, that's the good thing about Umbrella, since they're all region pre-releases. Like, you know, it's not that expensive to get these imported.
And I remember seeing that movie really early on. My dad had bought the Japanese LaserDisc because it was the only way you could see it widescreen. Mm. And I remember him showing it to me when I was a kid. And, you know, I had seen the Mad Max movies, but it was a depiction of Australia that you had never – it was very not fantastical. It was almost nightmarish and, you know, post-apocalyptic in its own way, you know, with these – the villains of the movie who have done wrong to this woman.
Cyberpunky.
Yeah, cyberpunky. Yeah, very weird.
Well, it makes
sense
in the Mad Max world, though, doesn't it? Because they're the same kind of characters.
Well, that was the thing. I was like, wait a minute. This isn't – I was like trying to process it because I was like, okay, this isn't the Mad Max world, but they certainly feel like they live in that. Is that what Australia's like?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember them taking me out of a bit because they're just so rapey and cyberpunky. It's a little weird.
Very weird. But it's a great movie. I picked it up at Amoeba last week.
Cool.
Yeah.
And didn't you see it theatrically not too long ago?
No, I showed it.
I feel like there's a big screening of this somewhere.
I showed it when I was doing Shuckley drop screenings at the New Bev.
Right.
And we had shown Razorback.
And Russell McKay came out, right?
Mulcahy came out.
I knew there was something like that.
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else?
I just want to throw a shout out to a great podcast that I finished last week called The Horror of Dolores Roach by Aaron Mark. And it's an 8-part series, really breezy to get through, but very graphic and very grand guignol in nature. And basically it is about a woman who did 16 years in prison because this guy set her up in a bad drug bust or something like that. And so she's out and she's trying to revisit her old neighborhood in New York.
Is this a docuseries or fiction?
No, it's fiction.
Okay.
And so what happens is she goes back to her old, you know, her old apartment. You know, it's being – the neighborhood's being gentrified. There's like a white couple living there. She's hoping to find the old stash of money that she had like hidden behind the walls, but now it's gone. So she's kind of like – she's stuck. And so she's an ex-con looking for work. So she goes to the local empanada shop that's still there, and she knows the owner, and the owner takes her in. And he's like, listen, you could stay here, work for me, do your thing. And she was like, fantastic, great. She's a great masseuse. So he like sets her up downstairs in the basement to set up a massage parlor. And sooner or later, there's a dead body in her hands. Mm. And she's like, fuck, I fucked up. And the guy comes downstairs. He's like, don't worry, I got this. I totally got it. Don't worry about it. Just go upstairs, go relax, go lay down. And so the whole thing is from her perspective, her POV. Mm-hmm. So the next time she goes back downstairs, he's like, got a new empanada recipe, guys. You guys going to try this. It's amazing. And she's like, oh, no, that is really good. And so what's happening is the empanada guy is basically turning people into meat.
Damn.
And it becomes kind of like a modern-day Sweeney Todd. Yeah. Right. And so it's her descent into madness and their mutual descent into madness as, you know, the bodies start to pile up and they're trying to cover their tracks and stuff. Really, really solid. I had a good laugh because it's a Gimlet podcast. And the first review that I saw before I downloaded it was like some woman going, Gimlet should be ashamed of themselves.
I just saw this.
Is absolutely disgusting. And I was like, ooh, I can't wait. And, you know, Dolores goes into, you know, them cutting up meat and what it looks like and all, you know, the smell. And she goes into rich detail about
how did it get on your radar? Because I never listened to things about
it. But we were sitting in a staff meeting and Blum goes, Ryan, listen. I'm listening to this really disgusting podcast. It's totally up your alley. And I was like, okay, what is it? And he told me about it. And he's like, I don't know if anybody else has got a strong stomach for this, but you like that weird shit.
I wonder how he found it. Because it's always weird. How do people discover
smaller
podcasts?
Yeah.
I'm always curious about that.
But Aaron Mark, the creator, I had a good chat with him the other day. And he He's a New York local who does like a lot of off-Broadway shows. Oh. And I guess this started as like a one-woman off-Broadway play. And he does a bunch of other ones like that. And but his whole thing is he loves horror and he does like a lot of Grand Guignol-esque stories. Huh. So if you live in New York, keep an eye out for his stuff. Out.
I have one more, which was my awesome surprise and will make my top 10. And I was not expecting it at all. I don't even know why I pushed play because I hadn't heard anything about it. It's on Shudder and it's, make sure you watch the, not the English language one. You watch the Indonesian version. Satan's Slaves is one of my gems of the year so far because some of the imagery and moments in it are, they're James Wan, like there's moments. I don't want to overhype it because it's still a smaller movie, but this was a huge movie in Indonesia. I think it was the biggest moneymaker of the year. And I'll just skip to the end for a second. It has an ending. The last minute was a tad confusing, but then I looked it up and realized it's a direct homage to the original. The original movie called Satan's Slave from Indonesia was a huge hit in 1980 there. And it's like hallowed ground. Apparently it's the horror film from Indonesia. Very hard to find, like almost impossible. I'm waiting for somebody to release it. And the director was so nervous to even take it on because that film's so popular to make a remake slash kind of sequel.
Right, right.
So the last image is actually that doesn't really ruin the movie at all. It ends with two characters who are actually characters from the original film, and so it's a little hard to understand when you're watching this movie. But that's the only moment that confused me at all. But man, there were so many moments in this movie. So it's and what's cool is it's a family in peril supernatural horror film. So it opens where a family's losing their mom. Basically, the mom character is dying, and she doesn't last very long at the start of this film. The dad's trying to hold this family together, and then the dad's just like, actually, I gotta get out of here for a while. I was kind of a little confused for a while at the start. Yeah. I found the first 15-20 minutes a little disorientating just because there's a lot of people. You're with the older sister. She's trying to look after her three siblings, and then they start to bring up this idea that, hey, what if mom had been barren and couldn't bear children, but then saw these Satanists? Because there's all these guys hanging around when we're young, and there's a reason none of us look the same. Like maybe we're all from like this weird Satanist kid. Yeah. And so that's just kind of the throwaway backdrop. But then the actual spooky shit starts to descend, and there's just so many good ghost gags. Yeah. There's an image of people with umbrellas towards the end that I thought was freaking scary. Yeah. And it's just, I think it's really good. And it does what so little horror does. And the reason why I sometimes do think, you know, unfortunately, that there's 10% good stuff out there, 9% bad, it's because I cared about these people by the end. I actually cared about this family unit. I cared about the little kid. I cared about the sister. I was like, by the end, I'm like, oh, I want good things to happen. That's so rare in horror because so often we're just like, oh, yeah, whatever. Even when the screenwriter has tried, they usually are just treating them as things to get swatted around. So this was a real surprise to me. I genuinely got to the end. It was like, I was not expecting this to be such an entertaining and well-made movie, especially well made. I mean, there's a gag with where they try to, the kids are scared to go to the bathroom at night. There's lots of that stuff you remember as a kid, and there's a scary portrait of their mother on the wall, so they try to put a sheet over it and it falls short and lands on something.
That's right.
And I was like, oh, that's going to be ripped off in America 10 seconds from now and be on an Annabelle 4 trailer, right? Like, or whatever. It'll be like the shock moment that we love in shock. But anyway, this is definitely, check it out. This for me was like definitely going to be one of those ones that you just see it at the end of the year and go, oh, cool. Like, this is actually a really good movie. But definitely keep your eye out when you finish it. Go watch. Like I did, I went straight to see the trailer for the original movie, and I bet you some company's going to put that thing out because it looked really interesting. It has kind of the same setup of the mother dying and the family thing, but this one looks like it had bigger bells and whistles to play with. You know?
Interesting.
I had no idea that there was that connection there.
I didn't either, because I was just so confused by the last like seconds of it. It's not
me
the whole movie.
Me too.
I was
like,
what is the ending? Who were those people? Yeah. And then I looked up and it was a direct homage. So in that country, it probably played gangbusters.
Oh, yeah.
But to Americans, we're like, I don't know what that was.
Yeah.
But it's interesting they have an American dubbed version, and I feel like with these kind
you
of movies,
watch stay
with
the original language.
Yeah, because it was fast, and it's so cool to see that movies are being made.
It's dubbed on Shudder?
There's two versions. I watched the Indonesian version, but I noticed there was an English language, and I bet a lot of people just kind of see that.
Quick play.
Do yourself a favor. Do a double feature if you have Shudder. You know, watch Terrified and Satan's Slaves together.
Yeah. These are two of the best surprises of the year, I've got to say. I love both of them. So anyway, that was a nice one to end.
Question for you guys. Mm-hmm. When was the last time you saw Dagon?
Why yeah, have you rewatched it recently?
I rewatched it over the weekend.
Okay, because I got that Blu-ray Vestron Lionsgate put out. Yep. And here's the thing. I love Stuart Gordon. This movie never sat with me even it initially came out. Like I just remember it being like a little too weird for me.
Yeah.
And I started it late a few weeks ago and I couldn't get into it again. I was like, all right, put it away.
Mm-hmm.
Try again later when you're, focused.
My only memory, I liked it when it first came out, but I remember liking the horror stuff, and I remember having a major issue, and I'd be curious to know with the lead guy, and he was really hard to follow as a lead.
Yeah.
It didn't make sense. He seemed too contemporary and hip or something.
I remember seeing it when it first came out, and Jared Rivett, and I had gone to a screening, so I got a chance to see it on a big screen, and I remember being blown away by Stuart Gordon's ambitions. It was like, okay, here is finally a very Shadow over Innsmouth kind of story, and the effects were, the practical effects, the fishermen were cool and all that stuff. And I thought it was incredibly clever the way Stuart started to unravel, what was going on in this village. Rewatching it, I think it's almost 20 years now.
Yeah, about.
And I just had such a problem with the pacing of it and the leading man, and those effects definitely don't hold up. And I started feeling bad because I was like, man, I really, really like this movie, but it's kind of hard to get into now. I almost feel like you should just special edition it and throw in some new Dagon effects and, because the whole opening, it deals with like a ship that's blowing, that's stuck in a storm, when you see the storm effects, you're like, oh, it starts to pull you out of it. But there's not enough human emotional journey, to kind of root you in everything. Yeah. It's a lot of things encroaching on this leading man and a lot of discovery, but not a lot of character discovery. It's just discovery. It's just like, I'm going to go to the next set piece, the next set piece, the next set piece, and see all the scary, weird stuff happening until it culminates in him meeting the girl again. And, I'm glad the movie got made. And I thought, again, the ambition is there. I just don't know if it holds up as well.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting movie. And because that lead,
Ezra Goddard, that's his name.
For a while, he was like Stuart's guy because he was in his Masters of Horror episode.
Yeah.
But then you're like, but he's not like – it's not like Jeffrey Combs where it's like peanut butter and jelly. Like it just works, that combination. And somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I heard or even saw a test version of Reanimator the Musical, and he was the original Herbert.
No way, really?
Before Graham.
Interesting.
But maybe like one performance or they try to a run through with it, and then thankfully they, no offense to this guy, but thankfully they found Graham, and Graham was terrific in that role.
I wonder if we could like CG Graham back into Dagon.
Just imagine Graham
Skipper's Dagon. If you're listening, Graham Skipper, we can make this happen.
Take on the special edition. You get all new VFX, and you get Graham Skipper.
You get the Skipper.
But I will tell you, if you didn't get to the features yet, the one thing I watched before I tried to watch the movie is there's a brand new great interview with Mick Garris and Stuart Gordon on the disc.
Oh, yeah.
And I watched that. And it's a lot of fun because they talk specifically about this movie. It's something Stuart had tried to make for like 20 some odd years.
Yeah,
like, he always had wanted to make it. And it was part of that weird Brian Usna Mexico deal that also spawned
Fantastic
Beyond the Animator.
Factory.
Yeah, which is interesting. I don't know if any of those movies turned out great. But yeah, he said their first screening was at some festival. It might have been Sidious or something. And the first question was somebody in the audience looked at Stuart, he's like, why would you make this movie?
Oh,
and he's like, he's like, why did you make this?
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand. Why would you make this?
Yeah.
And he's like,
that sucks.
You know?
Well, what's interesting is that it was a project that he's wanted to do for many, many years. And even though Stuart has always had one foot in the world of Lovecraft, I think the more interesting films to come out of, Gordon in the 2000s was movies like King of the Ants and his Masters of Horror. Stuck, I find, kind of clunky.
I like Stuck.
Edmund's interesting.
He's always
Edmund's a little too heavy. That's that David Mamet one he did.
It's almost William Macy.
It's probably too far. I mean, the actual script goes too far. But it's filmed really well. I watched it again recently, and I was like, fuck, this thing's dark.
Yeah.
But it's in, you know, it's a, like but a I, descent into hell.
Yeah, but I just wonder if, like, you know, Stuart Gordon's time as a director who was attuned so well to what Lovecraft was doing had passed, you know, and he was, you know, as a filmmaker, he was moving into much, you know, more, not more interesting, but into other thematic territories like King of the Ants, something more human.
He's a pretty experimental artist, too, when you think about where he comes from, so it makes sense he would always have to keep changing.
Yeah. Yeah,
I do want to give a quick shout out based on that great McGarris postmortem, also on this network episode with Henry Thomas.
It was
such a great, just like listening to a conversation between two old friends who've worked together a bunch. Yeah. But if you like Hill House as much as I liked it, it's great to hear some insights on that. And just I loved listening to Henry Thomas. He seems like such a cool dude.
Yeah,
super low key.
I mean, his whole history kind of. I never really heard him talk about what E.T. did to his life, and
they didn't talk about the frog dreaming, which I'm a huge fan of that movie. But from when he as a kid too, but yeah, anyway, no, but it was just a really good episode, so kudos Mick, that was good stuff.
I listened to his Joe Bob last week, and that was a great
that was a good one too.
I was actually on the way here, I've been listening to the Trailers from Hell podcast, which is Movies That Made Me.
Ernest Dickerson,
so good. Excellent.
One of the best episodes.
And I was just halfway through. Mick was on it, too, a few weeks ago, and it's great.
I haven't heard Mick
because he's mostly – what I love is – I think Don Coscarelli was on it, too.
Yep.
And I love Don, but, you know, obviously these guys always talk about horror. Don got to talk about his love of James Bond and, like, all these other genre things. So far with Mick, it's all been rock and roll movies.
Yeah.
And I have a whole list now because he loves, you know, those type of films.
Ernest Dickerson, anytime I hear him on anything, I've heard him on a couple different podcasts, I always feel like very close and taste of the things he loves. And I'm always kind of amazed. I mean, he's had such an interest. I mean, he shot Malcolm X.
I know.
He's like the cinematographer of Malcolm X and director of Demon Knight. Yeah. I love that kind of filmography.
And he shot
– But he's got great, really interesting taste.
Where is it? Is it on one of the Blu-rays? He shot B-roll on, I think, Day of the Dead. So the opening shots, like that, the stuff that you remember from the opening of Day of the Dead, like the newspaper and the
– Oh, okay.
Apparently he shot all that.
Huh. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I know it came up somewhere, either a podcast he was on or something.
Well, I'm glad we're talking about
that podcast. It was probably when he was on Mick's podcast.
Because it's Joe Dante's birthday today. So
hey!
Because it's his birthday, we should give him a
shout. They were recording. Happy birthday, Joe.
Yeah, so good. Yeah, exactly.
And if you're in Los Angeles tonight, the day that this podcast drops – I think it's at the Chinese. They're showing the whole 3D.
Yeah, on Friday.
With the Untold Horror guys.
Yeah,
which
I've
never seen in 3D. Yeah,
the whole is great. Cool. Here's the funny thing about that movie, by the way, is if you're in town, go see it. For a very small period of time, because the whole is not available in 3D in the US. There's like, I think, a UK Blu-ray. But for a while there, Netflix actually had a 3D option, and the whole was on there. So I've seen it in 3D when I first got my 3D TV, and it is excellent in 3D. Because again, it's like Joe shot it for that format. Yeah. And so, you know, it's kind of the same way if you look at Scorsese's what's the movie that he did in 3D that I'm drawing a blank on now?
Hugo.
Hugo, like, it's like... Oh, no, he is taking full advantage of this format.
Yeah.
Joe did that with The Hole, and I think it suffers a lot if you don't get to see it that way.
Because there were guys who, both him and Martin Scorsese, are obviously guys who saw real 3D and want to do it like that, not the new post-3D.
Totally, totally. So,
it's a great sense of depth, yeah.
Yeah, go see The Hole if you can.
Cool.
Last thing before we bring our guest on, I actually did a little episode about Black Friday with Brian Sauer, your co-host. you know, the pure cinema guy. I'm curious, did you guys take advantage of anything Black Friday-wise? Because I saw in the group a lot of people... We're hitting up Vinegar Syndrome and Severin and all that,
I was bad.
Or are we all too
I
broke?
Actually blame him. No, I blame him because he tweeted a tweet. Brian was like, hey, look, Vinegar Syndrome, an indicator sale. And then I clicked on both links, spent over $100 on Vinegar. So, but I was going to – a couple of the ones they recommended us I wanted to pick up, but I also wanted to get the Mausoleum and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did a
– So did you snag Mausoleum?
I did get that one. So
sold out now.
Hasn't arrived. Okay, well, you can borrow it once again. so I got that order. Then I went to Indicator for a bunch of things that I just like – region-free stuff because I still don't have other. And then I circled back to one other site. I literally hit three different – I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm not even kidding. I got one package in the mail. I go, I don't even remember ordering. That's how bad I've been. I must have been in a fever state. So, yes, I did commit sins on that.
I love it, man.
It was fun. And they were good deals. I mean, look, Criterion's is still crazy.
Yeah, I got that Bergman box set for half off.
Right. I got Cutting Class.
Cutting Class, all right.
I ordered Cutting Class, and I went to Severin, and I picked up
Oh my God! What did I get?
Skinner.
Yeah, I can't wait for that Blu-ray.
I knew nothing about that one, man. I gotta check that out. I want to watch that first. But All the Colors of the Dark would be good.
Yeah, very curious to see it many years later. Just slapped down at $30.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, and also another thing that came out that I watched this weekend that we'll be talking about soon is Dead Wax.
Momentarily,
yeah. Dead Wax. You know,
put on a record while we get ready to.
Should
bring
we
you
preface
up?
the next segment as
sure.
This is seizure inducing?
Oh yeah, seizure inducing. But put it on. And I love that actress. I forgot I had seen her before in the Fincher TV show.
Oh,
Was it Mindhunter? Mindhunter. I was looking at the whole, when it started. I was like, where have I seen this girl? And then I was like, okay. So yeah, there you
very
go.
Very cool. All right.
Segue well, that.
Let's bring on.
This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by RLJ Entertainment. Coming soon from RLJ is, drumroll please, All the Creatures Were Stirring, co-directed by Shockwaves' very own Rebecca McKendry. In the film, a young couple struggling through their first date on Christmas Eve end up in a spooky theater where they're shown several bizarre and twisted Christmas tales, all featuring scenes of holiday horror. All the Creatures Were Stirring stars Constance Wu, Jonathan Kite, Amanda Fuller, Jocelyn Donahue, Graham Skipper, Ashley Clements, Megan Duffy, and our Kane. You can find the film on Redbox now. It will be coming to VOD and Walmart on December 4th and hits Shudder on December 13th.
Proud of you, Becca. All right, tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. Some call it the Netflix of horror, but plain and simple, it's the best streaming outlet to get scary, weird, macabre, and great genre cinema. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest-growing, human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. To try Shudder for free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use promo code WAVES. All right, very happy to have Mr. Graham Resnick on the show. Graham currently has a show called Dead Wax on Shudder, and it debuted last week.
November 15th.
Would you call it a series, or what would you call it? Because the segments are so short, but overall, it's just a binge-worthy feature-length movie, too. What would you call it?
I mean, in a lot of ways, it is a little bit of a hybrid, the way I thought about it, but it's definitely a series in the way that the story was broken.
Yeah.
I don't think you could take all the chapter breaks and credits out and feel comfortable with it being a feature in the way that you typically think of a feature. You know, there's like an 18-minute interlude where you go to a guy in a radio station.
Yes.
You kind of couldn't do in a feature.
Yeah.
But, you know, each 10 to 15 minutes is broken out like a TV show would be. They're just kind of bite-sized.
And as you get into the show begins with a gentleman sitting down with his headphones enjoying a nice quiet evening, and he's about to listen to a record. And the next time we see him, he is a mummified corpse sitting on the couch. From there, it kicks off with a little bit of an investigation about a woman who is sought out to find a record that can kill you. Am I giving it a proper description?
Sounds about right.
Or is it the record or the frequency that's killing them?
Well,
let's get real.
Well,
real talk, straight talk. Is that a spoiler? Maybe a spoiler.
No, but you know that's part of the discovery. Okay. You know, there's some mythology. Okay. Yeah.
What I like about it is the setup, and I'm always intrigued by people who are taking you into a world that you may know or not know. The Ninth Gate, Roman Polanski's film, did it very well, but with Johnny Depp playing this kind of book collector / book hunter, and I was like, oh, I didn't know this kind of world existed, but it does exist.
Does this exist? Do people look for rare records like this outside of Discogs?
As in hiring somebody.
Yeah. Outside of Discogs?
Real humans actually go out.
I can't say specifically whether or not someone is hired like Johnny Depp or like Etta in but that has to be, because there are stuff that's not on Discogs and there's stuff that's really hard to get. And there's also collectors who can comfortably shop on Discogs, but they can't go into every record shop because they're very famous or wealthy or whatever. There are people who are also insane about finding ultra-rare records, especially blues records, 78s. There's a book by one of the writers. I'm going to mangle her last name. She used to write for Pitchfork, Amanda Petrovich, mm-hmm. something like that. And she wrote a book a few years ago about trying to find these super rare 78 blues records from a factory that's in, I want to say, like Cincinnati, somewhere like that. And the legend goes that all these records, which are one-offs, impossible to find again, and some of the best blues records ever recorded by people who like came in, sat down in front of a mic, recorded something, and then vanished forever. They were held in stock in the building and then at a certain point just dumped into the river. Right. So the legend goes, you can just scuba dive in that river and maybe find all these incredibly rare shellac records that probably would have survived because they're, you know, really tough material. And in her book, she actually goes scuba diving looking for those records.
Are you serious?
But I won't tell you how that ends.
Oh, man.
Right. And I'm reading that one, 1,000 Cuts. I just got it about the film industry, the film the film trading and all the people like Mike Williamson, Phil Blankenship, all the people who collect 16, 35, but how it used to be against the law and the FBI were, well, it still is technically, but the FBI would raid these people and arrest people. And you're like, that's crazy. It's like they're like adventure stories. It's kind of exciting.
They're not allowed to own film prints?
Yeah, well, you're not allowed to screen them. Yeah, back then you weren't allowed to. Oh, wow. I don't really know what the law is. Now I've just started this book, but we know so many people obviously do. Maybe it's just not enforced now. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it might be one of those.
I have a fun tidbit that I would never be able to bring up on this show until right now, thanks to you, Henry Rollins, avid record collector. I interviewed him for a documentary project, and so I got to see his temperature-controlled media room.
I've seen pictures. I've drooled over those.
I've been in there, and it is amazing. And when you talk to him, he is one of these – because you had mentioned before, it's like some people are too famous that they can't do this. Or he's one of those dudes. So I was looking at his record wall, and he owns multiple copies of every album. And I remember being like the Buzzcocks is one of his favorite bands. He's got like multiple copies. And I'm like, are those just like for friends or in case it wears out? He's like, no, it's every pressing from every part of the world. I need to have one of every one.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. Okay. Crap. So everything – he buys every version, like the US press, the UK, whatever. He buys every pressing. He buys test pressings. And he also shops nonstop. He's always online.
Yeah.
Whether he's on tour or whatever. So packages always show up at his place. And he never looks at a price. He's that well – like, you know, because I mean, he does the books and the tours and shows and movies. He's wealthy enough that he never he'll buy – if he wants it, he'll buy it.
Yeah.
That's it. Money's no question.
Yeah.
And I just thought, wow.
If I do another season of the show, I want to try to get Henry Rollins.
Oh, that'd be cool.
I can maybe help.
He's the perfect person for it. Yeah.
It's like there is a fan out there that bought every copy that Anchor Bay ever put out of Evil Dead 2 and beyond.
Probably.
Like, oh, my gosh. You have quite the Evil Dead 2 collection. Well, I bought it everywhere. And it's like 10 copies.
Is that the most pressed movie
it feels
ever?
Like it doesn't.
I'm going to say Halloween.
Yeah, Halloween probably. Yeah.
I think that's been
I saw Evil Dead 2 on 4K. And I was like, oh, God damn it.
I bought it. $7.99 Black Friday.
So, Graham, tell us a little bit about the origins of Dead Wax, where it came from, your relationship with Shudder.
Sure. Well, Sam Zimmerman.
Yes.
At the end.
Are you going to find the glue?
It's the glue.
Sam is the glue that brings us all together.
Yeah. And I know you through Sam as well, Ryan. And Sam used to work for Fangoria years ago and then Chalk to the Drop, and now he's at Shudder and he curates with Colin Geddes, and they just do an amazing job, as we all know. Yeah. And they had asked me to come in a couple years ago to talk about a script that I had that they really liked, and they thought they could maybe do it as a short form series, which was something they wanted to get into at the time. But it didn't feel quite right breaking a narrative feature into the short form nuggets, kind of like we were talking about before. It wasn't the story didn't like exactly work. So I wanted to build something from the ground up, and I had the Dead Wax idea for a couple of years. I just liked the idea of you know, taking the Cigarette Burns, Ring, High Fidelity, and Ninth Gate things, and just mashing them into one story, and then using that as a jumping off point to go in wild new directions. And I didn't have much more of a pitch, but I went in to pitch Owen Shiflett, and I think it was this notebook in my pocket. It's still in here because I pulled out the wrong one recently. But I went in for a general, and I just had those five titles listed, and I didn't know what I was going to pitch. Yeah. And we got to chatting, and I was like, "Oh, I think he'd like this." So I pitched it, and that was the day before the election, 2016. So I got really excited because he really liked it, and then I took a break from being excited about anything for a while and circled back to it.
Yeah.
And
now that things are fine in this country.
Now that things are totally fine.
Because everything's fine.
Everything's back to normal.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So when did principal photography begin?
Last March.
Last March.
Or this March.
Wait.
This past March.
This past March, yeah.
2018.
2018. Yeah. Almost a year ago.
And talking about like serializing it, so you broke, you know, so you left off with a cliffhanger. I mean, did that affect the production at all in terms of how you tackled it or
yeah, what? Did you shoot it like a movie or?
Yeah. So that was the thing. It was like, you know, it's very low budget, but not out of the realm for low budget for a TV show, but kind of normal for like small indie features. Right. So we were like, okay, we know how to do this if we can do it as a small indie feature. So we block shot it. There are some places, some locations in LA that we used that I've shot in, that a lot of other people have shot in. This is one house in Altadena called the Woodbury Story House. And mm-hmm. I shot something there. Some of the signal was shot there. Tons of stuff. And we shot for 4 days, and I think we shot like 15 script locations there, just different rooms of the house we just dressed in. Which is a trick I learned from House of the Devil. Like when we were in that house in House of the Devil with Ty, just like the attic was like the college dorm room, and the, you know, like we just redressed areas of a house. And
there just clarify for the listening audience what you did on House of the Devil.
Primarily sound design, but I was on set as a still photographer. So I took the stills.
I was on that set for Fangoria. Yeah,
I remember.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
I got in a lot of trouble because I remember the house. It was really cool to be there, and it was also felt kind of like out of the middle of nowhere because I drove from New York to Connecticut.
Yeah.
But then what I remember is in the basement was the giant pentagram.
Yeah.
And somebody somebody took a photo of me at the pentagram. And then Tony Timpone had pushed me, as he usually did, for some kind of scoop. And so I don't even remember what I told them. I was like, oh, well, they told me they're doing this. And it went up, and I got a very angry email from Ty being like, why did you, you know? And so I never got that photo because everybody involved with the production hated me for scooping something.
I don't remember that. If I have the photo, I'll look for it.
Look for it, please.
I don't know.
That'd be amazing.
And then talk a little bit about casting and finding your Edda.
Sure. Edda was really hard because that character is someone I wanted to be, and it's turning out to be a little controversial, which I'm kind of enjoying in some ways. I wanted to have Edda be this classic film noir cipher character.
Yes. Yeah.
She's Mike Hammer from Kiss Me Deadly.
Yeah.
And it's Kiss Me Deadly is the other huge influence on this. Those other characters, and Decker and Soberin are both Kiss Me Deadly names. And, you know, the record's the great What's It. And so, I mean, she's doing Mike Hammer's teeth smile.
She like, really is,
It's amazing. Yeah. Like I gave her the DVD to watch and she was just like, oh yeah, this is, you know, and we wanted someone to be just like putting their personal Hannah was doing that, and I wanted her to like find this space where you see this in detective characters where you see the balance between humanity and obsession just teetering constantly. And the whole, I don't want to get into spoilers, but for me, the whole story of this chapter of the larger story, if we do more seasons, is about a character recognizing that they've crossed that threshold.
Yeah,
and so it was a big challenge to find someone who could pull that off, and you could see the humanity underneath coming into tension with like this front they've put up. So she's trying to be the tough noir character the whole time. And when we realized that when we hit upon Hannah Gross, we were just like, oh shit, she's perfect. And we reached out to her, it's mutual friends, and she said yes pretty much right away, and that's how we got.
Had you seen Mindhunter?
I had seen Mindhunter
because I definitely noticed her in that. I was like, "Oh, who's that?"
Totally,
that's somebody I didn't, you know, the chemistry there.
And she's in Marjorie Prime in a brief scene in that. She plays young Marjorie, and she stands out. And she was great and super into it, and really took that direction to heart, and I think pulled it off really well. So I'm excited to keep going with that.
No, that's awesome. You got a lot of great other character actors. You got Ted Raimi.
Mm-hmm. Ted.
And then you have another you have an actress that comes in kind of late to the series, but I was absolutely fascinated by because of her delivery is Yuki mm-hmm. Sakamoto.
Yeah.
Where does she come from? Who is that?
Yuki is someone I cast last year in an interactive horror series that hasn't come out yet, but I shot it almost 2 years ago. And we needed a Japanese actress, and through casting, they brought her in. I don't know how they found her, but she was just perfect. And she has the look and the – especially in this other thing that I had been doing. She was playing someone who hadn't slept in weeks, like just wasn't unable to sleep. And she just has this like very classic Japanese horror kind of vibe.
Exactly.
Which I really liked. And English is not a first language, and so she was kind of new to it, to acting in English a year or two ago. But I liked her so much in that that I wrote that role for her, and she came back and just, I thought, you know, nailed it. And
yeah, there's really definitely great. Something incredibly eerie about her and yeah. the way her delivery, you know, yeah. and just and you've got this kind of bandaged guy sitting off to the left of her. It's like, okay. Any fun Ted stories?
Yeah, Ted was awesome. He actually, we were trying to cast that role, and that was another hard one to cast. I wanted someone very serious and very and much older, and very dry. And then Ted just showed up in an audition.
What? Oh,
out wow. of nowhere.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
Read for
it? He just came in, and I wasn't even there. That I was there for a lot of it, but I wasn't there for that day. And yeah. so the casting, Lisa Fields, who's great, she sent me an email. She was like, look who came in today. And I opened it, and as soon as I saw him and he opened his mouth, I was like, oh, he's the character.
Oh, wow.
And he plays it like a, like an older, like hipster record store clerk.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is like
yeah.
such a great read on that character.
Basically Rob G in about 10 years.
Oh, Christ. I mean, maybe not even that long. But no, I love Ted. Ted was on our show, and it was one of the best yeah. interviews ever because, I mean, you look at his career and everybody he's worked with.
He's a legend.
Perfect. Yeah.
He's and I was a huge Twin Peaks fan, and he's in Twin Peaks.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I had this hat on, the Twin Peaks hat.
You got the ring. You got the hat.
Yeah,
he was in that very questionable part of Twin Peaks, season the end two, of season middle. Two.
I like the I end think, of season two.
I believe Diane Keaton even directed one yeah. of those episodes.
Yeah.
That
oh,
one,
wow.
one of the wackier episodes yeah, yeah, yeah. of season yeah, yeah. two. I remember going, Diane Keaton? How'd that happen?
Yeah, all the guys lined up at the bar.
Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah. yeah. That's crazy. But.
I have a lot of stuff I want to talk to you about music-wise because I joke that I know you based on your record collection, your baby, and your love of Twin Peaks. But what a lot of people – the first time I heard your name because we're New York guys mm-hmm. And I love Larry Fessenden and Glass Eye Picks and that whole crew. And it just became – it was the early Ty West movies and
oh, yeah.
basically realizing, especially seeing something like House of the Devil on the big screen, the sound, you know, and I know this sounds stupid, but like – it was the first time I actually wanted to know who did the sound on this movie. And that's you. You actually come from a background doing sound design. And so I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that. I mean, was that kind of the first thing, you know, are you from New York originally or how did you hook up with that crew and in particular Ty?
Sure.
And was that the first thing you wanted to do in film sound?
No. Sound was a sort of a sidetrack for me, but something I liked doing. I grew up with Ty in Delaware. We made a lot of short films together, as you do, blowing up G.I. Joes with M-80s and whatnot. I was at NYU and Ty was at SVA. And so I was in the directing track there and Ty was in the directing track at SVA. And he had, I believe, sophomore year, his teacher was Kelly Reichardt, filmmaker.
Mm, yeah,
and she noticed Ty and she doesn't do horror specifically, but she knows Ty was doing horror. She was like, oh, you should meet my friend Larry Fessenden. So she introduced Ty to Larry.
Because her first film is Larry's the Star. It's like a Lovers yeah. on the Run film.
Oh.
It's Larry and I can't remember who the other actor is. It's a good
yes.
movie.
Yeah.
Just the title just left my
yeah.
brain.
Rivergrass.
That's
yeah.
it, yeah.
And Larry did the sound design for that as well and edited it.
Oh, I didn't know that part.
Yeah. And so Larry's actually always been a big champion of sound, so he's really pushed that. But yeah, Ty was Larry's intern during Wendigo, and then that's how I met Larry. And then Ty did The Roost about a year after college, and then I did I Can See You about 2 years after college,
mm-hmm.
And Ty did Trigger Man. So I joke that I made a very experimental movie at the worst time in the world to release a movie, which was late 2008, early 2009 after the crash. So doing a lot of sound design to pay the bills. But I – luckily, with that crowd, with Larry, got to work with incredible filmmakers who were all friends, like people from NYU, like Jim Mickle and Ty and Larry himself. And getting to work with filmmaker peers in that way was really an incredible learning experience for me. I just got to like pick everyone's brain constantly and you know just absorb so much. And you know, it gave me the opportunity to work as a sound designer in a way that someone at a post house doesn't always get to, and that's not to diminish people who work at post houses, but there's sort of like this different relationship when you're a hired post house to do the sound versus like a friend coming in. They let me be a little more creative than I would normally be. Mm. Like with Ty, our relationship is kind of just like we have a weird telepathy because we've known each other for so long. So because of that and because of Larry sort of fostering how important sound is in all these films, we got to do and try a lot of stuff that I don't think we'd have gotten to try otherwise, which was cool.
Wow. But did you have any sort of music or – because obviously music's big for you now. No. But even early on, were you always like – I guess what I'm trying to say is like not a lot of people have the ear that you have both for music and sound. And the whole thing with Larry makes sense is because I remember one of the first times I interviewed Larry, he confessed that he snuck a tape recorder into Jaws and recorded it, and he couldn't afford to go see Jaws all the time.
Yeah.
He would just listen to Jaws on a tape all the time.
Totally.
And I'm like, no wonder you're so obsessed with sound, because you literally would tape movies and re-experience them like auto-wise. So no, I mean, like, you just have a knack for it. So I mean, was that always present in your work?
I think so. I actually always love that story about Larry, because I did the same thing when I was a kid. Not with the tape recorder in the theater, but I would record like Twin Peaks off of the TV onto a tape recorder and listen to that in the car, you know, because we didn't have iPhones to watch stuff over and over again. And I just wanted to, you know, it was comfort food for me. So I would listen to movies, you know, when I'm driving around or whatever. But yeah, I mean, sound is one of those things that I think a lot of directors don't, it's a black box for a lot of directors. Same way as editing is for some people or VFX, but I think the generation that, you know, is making films now, more so than, you know, folks who were older when I was just starting, we all grew up with computers, and we grew up with, you know, I had Adobe Premiere in my school's computer lab, and I had pirated software at home that I could mess with in 1998, you know, and I basically would just like build little movies and do the sound design and do everything because you could, you know, and you see, you know, you see that happening more and more. It's not as regimented now, and I think that's important from a like creative standpoint. Like the way that filmmakers now are seeing the gestalt of everything, like all the pieces put together to make something more than the sum of its parts, I think is really I think it existed before, but it's something that is like a lot more prevalent now. And even as a sound designer for hire, when I get edits from directors and editors, they're way more filled out. And way more – like people are like thinking of sound when they're editing, which is great.
Well, I like the way you took that kind of degree of obsession and kind of fascination and curiosity for sound and applied it in a – and you manifested it in a visual way. When you watch Dead Wax, you're seeing – it's almost fetishizing you know, record players and speakers, and the way you kind of get up close and you see the texture.
Yeah,
You know,
never seen shots like that before. Records, man.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, there's a couple moments where someone's just listening to something on an old timey record player, and you're just seeing the threads of the speaker. You know, I just loved all of that kind of texturing.
I was going to ask you before we started, and they yelled at me. The theme track itself, they're like, save it for the show. But the theme track is just one of those. It's super catchy, and because when he first said we had to watch the show before you were coming on, I thought each episode was like an hour.
Oh, yeah.
So because I didn't know the context yet, I pushed play, and then, 13 minutes, all right. But so it's again, I think that track helps you want to keep diving back in, because there's just something kind of hypnotic about it. But.
Which do you – because there's no specific theme, but are you thinking of the ones when they're playing the records?
No, I'm thinking of like what starts each episode.
Oh.
It varies, doesn't it?
Oh, I did. It all sounded – I just thought it was the same track. I watched the entire show at one time, so.
There is a repeated
thing. I don't have a good ear.
There's a repeated like thematic music element when the title comes on.
Yeah, that's probably what I mean.
And that's stuff that I made.
Okay, cool.
But we had a lot of like incredible guest electronic musicians that Spencer Hickman from Death Waltz corralled for us. And he's sort of a partner with this in putting that together. And I think after episode one was just my stuff, and after episode one, all the material started trickling in as I was editing. So I basically cut stuff in as I got it, and it just kind of worked all when I got it. But we had I'm not going to list everybody because I would forget someone. And
I was trying to write a lot of them down as I saw them in the credits.
You can wait for the soundtrack, which I believe Death Waltz and Mondo is putting out, right?
Yes. Any day now, very soon. But yeah, it'll be a double album with my score and then with the guests, who are all fantastic. And
that's great.
I think there's a lot of stuff that you don't hear in the show because you can only hear little snippets. So
yeah,
I think it's going to be cool.
I just want to back up a little bit because this is the first time we've had you. Wait a minute, have you only been on the show?
No.
We talked about it way back.
Not on Killer POV?
No, we talked about it long.
First appearance ever. We've always wanted him on.
Until Dawn.
Oh, yeah.
The video game that you wrote.
Yeah.
I am a giant fan. In fact, I realize that I'm long overdue. Once I'm done with Red Dead Redemption, I'm probably going to go dip back in and just clear the slate. And
so in like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But revisit Until Dawn and take some new narrative threads. It was cool. It was a game that that was very much like a horror choose-your-own-adventure story. And as you followed a bunch of kids that go out to a cabin in the woods in a snowy environment and shit goes wrong. You wrote the script with Larry?
Larry and Supermassive Games.
Okay, with Supermassive. Take us through the process on that. I'm very curious to hear, as someone who comes from film and sound and how you jump into a new medium like that.
It was a weird, weird, interesting and fulfilling experience I learned a lot from as a writer. I wouldn't have said I was a good writer before that. I won't say I'm a good writer now, but I'll say I'm a seasoned one. and I have confidence now in the things I'm writing because it was just – I think I've made the gross estimate of 10,000 pages over 4 years that went into it in the PS3 version and the PS4 version combined. But that's how much work went into it.
Right.
We have a Guinness World Record for the most amount of pages.
Wow.
It's insane. Yeah.
I keep writing to Guinness. They haven't sent me. I think we got asked to do it originally in like 2011 because – and this is – the game's been out for 3 years. Now there are Wendigos in the game and Fessenden did a movie called Wendigo. Yeah. So I think he was asked to submit and he just thought it was like going to be a little sample. And he was like, oh, I don't really know video games at all. He kind of grew up right before video games, but he appreciates them and he loves new technology and he loves like interactive things and 3D and he's always into that kind of stuff. And he knew that I was a big gamer. And we had written a little bit before, so he asked me to help write this pitch. So we sat around in his kitchen and realized that it was a feature-length script we were writing over a weekend because a sample chapter from the game looked like 15 pages, but that was – like writing prompts and it filled out to be about 150 pages. And that sample chapter that we wrote was the chapter where I'm forgetting the names, Mike and his new girlfriend go up to the cabin. And it's like the comedic chapter.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's still in the final version of the game.
Wow.
Many years later. But that, that property existed even before Supermassive as a vague idea. And I think there's like early demos of the company who was working on it previously that you can find online. And then Supermassive took it over, revamped the whole story, then brought us on as dialogue writers. Then that process took 2 years, almost finished. Mm. And that's when the PS4 was being developed. And I think at some point someone at Sony was like, you know what, let's turn this into a much more cinematic thing. And so we had to redo the whole script. And rewrite it – like the original version was way more like it was first person. It was for the PlayStation Move. It was way campier. A lot of prompts of like – very like video gamey prompts of people shouting things at you off screen like, hey, we should open that gate probably. But then they wanted to do it much more like a film because of this new facial capture technology, which everyone was super excited about.
Yeah.
And we got some really great actors like Rami Malek.
Rami Malek. Like, yeah. I know.
And Mr. Robot hadn't even come out yet.
Yeah.
So we didn't know – I mean like we knew him from some short – some smaller projects.
Right.
Like Short-Term 12 and stuff. But he came in. And he's one of those people who just read the lines and you were just like, oh, that guy's a big movie star. No one knows it yet, but he's a big movie star.
Here he is doing our game.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it was like amazing. So that was 2013 point. So then it was another 2 years before it came out. But we rewrote it then, and then I lost my thread.
And well, did they keep you looped in during the entire progress?
Sometimes, and because it's like being part of a TV writer's room in some ways, except way more spread out because we were in the States, and at a certain point I was in LA already, and Larry was in New York, so we were Skyping and writing chapters late at night, drinking a lot of whiskey. So any of the weirdest lines in the game, you can attribute to that.
And did Larry ultimately play the game? Do you know?
Larry came to my apartment in LA and played about 2 hours of the game. It was delightful.
More important than that is, did John Carpenter play the game, and what did he think? Because Carpenter is the ultimate gamer.
I've always been curious about that. Does anyone know?
I bet you could trace his
Twitter. He probably tweeted about it.
He tends to write up little things. Yeah.
I like that John recently tweeted about the new Fallout game. Yeah. He was like, mixed bag. Got a lot of problems, a lot of glitches, but so far so good.
Yeah,
it was pretty funny.
I mean, you would figure he would play Red Dead Redemption because of the cowboy element.
Oh, yeah.
You know? No, so has there been any other video game prospects since then? After, because Until Dawn was a success.
It wasn't. It won a BAFTA. Yeah. It's a weird thing, and I'm never sure how much I'm supposed to say because NDAs and all that. But there's no sequel to Until Dawn, but there are two tie-in games.
There were two tie-in. It was like a VR.
Two VR games. Mm-hmm. One's called Rush of Blood, which is like one of the very first VR games, and it's like a weird roller coaster ride, and we wrote all the dialogue for it. And Larry plays this crazy like carnival character who guides you through this House of the Dead style shoot 'em up. It's great.
Yeah.
And then the next one was The Inpatient, which is a direct prequel to the game, also VR, but way more like Until Dawn. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. You can when you see a dialogue prompt on screen, you can speak your dialogue choice, which is kind of like an amazing thing. And then we also did a game called Hidden Agenda, starring Katie Cassidy, that is a Until Dawn style game that's like a police procedural. Mm-hmm. And you play it with four people. So they were trying to do the whole party game thing that Until Dawn kind of has. And you all connect your phones and then everybody votes on the different choices. So you can try to fuck your friends over or whatever. it's like you don't know Jack, kind of like you can kind of screw people over, which is
right.
Cool. And there's a new game called Man of Medan that is coming out soon that is very Until Dawn like. But that's all I can say about that.
I think I heard about this on the online. I, if you look at my computer, I've just got like post-it notes of video games that I'm like tracking, keeping an eye on. That's one of them.
There's a whole two-player aspect to that, which is remarkably cool and interesting. That I can't say anything.
Yeah. Fair enough. That's cool.
I was really pleasantly surprised a couple of months ago, just catching up on a stack of Blu-rays, and I popped in Bushwick, which I knew was the directors of Cooties, but I didn't know anything else about it. And your name pops up, a writer credit. And I was like, oh shit, I had no idea Graham wrote this. And I thought it was a really cool movie. I mean, really interesting, the whole just basically almost in real time of what's going on, it was almost like when a zombie outbreak breaks out, but it has nothing to do with zombies. It's actually like a military threat thing.
It's so,
a
war.
I'm just wondering, like, where did that kind of come from? How did that end up being something that those guys directed as opposed to something that, you could have done at some point?
Well, I came on as a rewriter on that, actually.
Oh, okay.
Carrie and John, I think, came up with the story a year or two before I came on to it. And the interesting thing about that film is that it premiered at Sundance the day after the inauguration. So it was super timely. Wow. It was really, really interesting. Nick DiMicci, Jim Mickle's writing partner, wrote the first draft of the script. And then I believe he was unavailable because he started Happen Leonard. And so I was asked to come in partially because I knew Bushwick pretty well, just because I lived there for a while.
Who knows that town?
Yeah. I came in and did some work on it. And ultimately, it's an interesting film because of the long take nature of it. There's a lot of improvisation and there's a lot of – they had to reinvent a lot of stuff on set. So like while they were shooting, they would send me pages to do some touch-up on. And then even with that, there's just like a lot of like improv and stuff that happened, but it's a interesting, fascinating story that I think, it's bizarre how like it felt like a weird fantasy movie when we were writing it, and then the day it came out, it felt like way too close to home.
Yeah,
well, it was way too close to home, but it felt like to me because it's about Texas breaking off from the U.S. and invading Bushwick because they think that, oh, let's just pick a spot that might not fight back.
Yeah, it'll be easy.
That'll be totally easy.
Like, you pick that?
Well, what's scary, it's like it's Texas and then rallying the other southern states. And when I first saw it at Sundance, I had the kind of same vibe. There was like an inner 12-year-old Ryan had watched Red Dawn for the first time, and I was oh my God, but I'm seeing it through the eyes of an adult man, man with a kid now, and I'm like, oh man, this is way too scary now. I think that movie holds up really well, and I think it's got I think Batista holds it up pretty well.
He's great,
Brittany
man.
Brittany
He's
Snow's really great good in it. Yeah. It's just got an energy to it that it still clicks with me. I put a throw it on every once in a while when I see it on VOD.
Yeah. And that soundtrack, A$AP Rocks.
Oh, A$AP Rocks. Yes. Oh, I mean that is the perfect score for that movie.
It's really good.
Very 70s vibe. Yeah. Really cool. Yeah, check out Bushwick if you guys out there haven't seen it yet. So.
Yeah.
I remember you talking about it way back, and it popped up, and then maybe it was too close to, everything's okay again in the country, so I guess we're fine. I already stated that, so it's fine.
It's much scarier now, Elric. I'm sorry to break it to you.
So the ending of Twin Peaks Season Return, tell me your interpretation. While you're on live.
What ending?
Yeah, exactly. It's an opening, a loop to another possibility.
What year is this?
Did you love the return?
I
How'd you feel about that it came back finally after all these years?
I was happened to have my phone open because my phone's always open, and I happen to be on Twitter because I'm always on Twitter. And I saw Mark Frost and Lynch tweet at the same time that Gummy Like is going to come back. And I was like, what's happening? Something's happening. What's happening? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. And I was having like a panic attack. And then like an hour later, there was more information and then more information, and they announced it. And it was unbearable. And this was before I had a kid, so my priorities have changed. But at that moment, all I could think is, I've got to stay alive for this. I don't know how I'm going to. Firewalk with Me is the reason I'm a filmmaker. It's why I got into filmmaking. I saw that and realized that you could do things in film that were dramatic and horrific and artistic and still commercial. And
you could have Chris Isaak patting people down on a school bus with little kids. So it's also funny and weird. Exactly.
I mean, that was, like the Rosetta Stone for me. Yeah. So I was so excited about the return, and I was shooting as it was airing. I was shooting this interactive thing last year, and my DP on that is a guy named Scott Ressler, and he was one of the second unit DPs on the return. So he shot like the drone shot going over the falls, and he shot a lot of the stuff at the roadhouse and a lot of exteriors and B-roll. And he had read the whole script. He's one of the only people. He went into a room and sat and read the whole script. And so I would see him every day as it was airing, and he'd be like, oh, it was pretty interesting last night. You know, in the next episode – and I would stop. But it was really neat to hear little tidbits about the show as it aired.
About the process.
There's nothing in my entire life that I've missed more, because even while it's on, there's some moments that were so perplexing or confusing or like you want a little more, and then other times it's overwhelmingly brilliant. But when it ended – mm-hmm. I've never missed – even the original I didn't miss as much as I missed that weekly something to look forward to that's unusual that you can actually talk to people about because you didn't know what it was.
The discussions and like the community was so – and then there were all these like secret codes in it, which were amazing. Did you guys see that stuff where like there's the stock like footage of the plane? Yeah, the windows are blinking.
Yeah.
And then the Lynch Frost logo, they're doing the same thing. And nobody's figured out exactly what all that means.
including Lynch, right? Because he loves to –
They managed to take the thing from the end of the first the end of the first show was like it kept the show alive for 25 years and now they've like managed to do that again.
And I think that final moment without any spoilers, but the final seconds are some of the scariest I've ever experienced in anything because then it ends and you're like left in oblivion and it's really kind of terrifying.
And you know what's coming. You know as like the last 10 minutes are counting down, you're like, oh God, we're not going to get to any resolution. No. This is
That first episode was that was the most perplexing because you're going, oh, we're Twin Peaks is back, and then you're in New York City and your brain goes, what? And then you're in Las Vegas and you're like, wait.
What's happening?
And then after it ended, you really appreciate that kind of artistry, right?
Just
take bold risks, you know?
And that episode 8 was a direct influence on me wanting to do the episode in Dead Wax where it's just a separate thing, you know?
Yeah.
With the disc jockey?
Yes.
The disc jockey episode is my favorite one because also I was just interested in the guy. I like the guy too. I was like, who is this?
Chester Rushing is great.
Yeah,
he's really in Stranger Things. He's one of the Steve's posse.
That's right. He is. Yes.
Yeah, he's really, really good.
Yeah, that was I almost wish like if season 2 takes off, we go back to him at some point.
Yeah.
I'd really like – I'm not ruling any characters out.
Yeah.
There's time and there's also other things.
Plus, you haven't had Fessenden in it yet. Come on. Where's Larry? He's got to come into
get the Fez.
He was supposed to play a small part that I had to write
a beetle. He played a beetle.
He unfortunately was injured when we had to shoot.
Too bad.
Play out.
Man.
He's okay now.
Did you work on at all with him on his – what he's shooting the Frankenstein film?
I was shooting Dead Wax at the same time.
Okay.
He had just wrapped that, so I was in prep. And it kills me that I couldn't work on it. But I have seen a cut and it is fantastic.
Awesome.
Anybody who's curious. Because
what's his first film that's kind of a Frankenstein retelling before?
Yeah,
what's the name
of it?
No Telling. So that's really cool that he's getting that chance to come back to it. Yeah,
totally. And he's been wanting to make this movie for years. I've read drafts since like 2010, I think.
I remember he one of the times I felt the coolest ever is I was working at Amoeba in Hollywood, mm-hmm. which is like I work at a video store. But he came in to visit, and everyone's like, "Is that Larry Fez?" I was like, "Yep, he's here to see me." But anyway, he bought like The Bride with Sting.
Oh yeah,
like this is like 6-7 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
He was buying Frankenstein movies back then because he'd been working on it that long.
Yeah,
and I think at one point maybe you thought about turning it into a show.
He did.
And then
he had
a feature again.
He had a great pitch, which was kind of at the dawn of this new era of long form TV, but his pitch for it was pretty amazing, which is it's too bad he wasn't able to do that, but like it kind of followed Frankenstein to this place where he became like a captain of industry, and I mean it was
interesting,
really really neat, and a great metaphor for capitalism in the United States.
This is the portion where we don't ask you about your films, we just ask you about filmmakers, you know. So what is that person up to? What's the tie up?
Well, I did want to ask,
I did that off air, so
you had done a short film when I was running Shock Till You Drop a long time ago, and you had Angus Scrimm do the voiceover, which was quite magical. Had you known Angus? I mean, were you friendly with him? I mean,
through Glass Eye, and actually at that point I had done my Tales from Beyond the Pale episode, The Grandfather, which Angus was in.
Got it.
I had a working relationship with his as a director at that point, and I came to LA and he just did that for free, that little short, which was amazing.
Man.
I just gave him a list of candy and I said, read this in an interesting way.
He did. He did. And you can find it on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
It's still on YouTube.
What's the name of that one?
The Trick is the Treat.
The Trick is the Treat. Cool. Cool. Well, you mentioned how influential Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me was on you as a filmmaker. I mean, we always ask all our filmmakers, let's go back to the very beginning. Like, what were the first horror movies as a kid that really just had made this impact on you? And, you know, for all of us, it's kind of that drug that we're always chasing again, getting that feeling back. So what was it for you?
Dumbo.
Dumbo, really? Yeah, are you excited for the new one?
I saw the very first trailer and I was like, I'm interested in what this is going to be, but I'm going to stay away from trailers. It's just too weird to do that. I'm curious. But Dumbo, the pink elephant scene is just – I mean it's like – and it seems like I'm joking, but I'm not. It is like this pure expression of innocence turned into, oh, reality is not at all what you think it is. You're fucked. Mm. Everything is fucked and you're done. Like that – like it's so insane.
Well, all those movies have that Kinder trauma quality.
Yeah,
Sleeping Beauty. All of these films have that thing that's actually Willy Wonka. Yeah. Really terrifying if you see. And it's a great way to get kids ready for stuff.
Yeah.
Right? It's like just slip it in there.
I miss that. I feel like a lot of kids' programming now doesn't have that.
And it feels like a lot of cartoons and like animation is being made actually for the minders of kids now.
Yeah.
Like, oh, the kids will like this, but it's really for the dads so they can laugh and have it. And I'm like, I don't make it for us.
No. We're going to be bored no matter what.
The repetition will be us.
Dumbo is a huge one. And then the Evil Dead movies, obviously, everybody, like, you know.
Yeah.
And then Lynch, and I do feel like a lot of Lynch's work is horror. And I feel like I've only realized this recently now with, and I still haven't seen the new Suspiria, but with thinking about Argento again a lot lately, I forget how influential his movies and a lot of that sort of like very, very big and bold filmmaking was influential on me, and Carpenter. Mm. They're so stylized, but they're also, especially Carpenter, they're filmmakers who like take you to these insanely weird places, but they don't feel like there's a barrier. Like you go into a Carpenter movie and you're like, I'm just going to have a good time. And then suddenly people are getting pulled through mirrors and screaming in strobe lights as they're suffering fates worse than death in this like weird nether dimension. And that's insane. Like, how do you get there? Like that's – you can't like say that's a mainstream movie, but it kind of is.
Yeah.
Like that's awesome. And I feel like that's like this amazing sweet spot where you can make mainstream stuff for people but also show them this like insane weird outer outland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
which I love.
That's pretty cool.
Favorite Lynch movie? Lost Highway.
Yeah.
Do you want me to answer for you? Or do you
sure.
Want to
I mean, I'll just say yes to all of them.
I know. Yeah.
But actually, I feel like I talk about this a lot and people get mad at me, but I like Lost Highway more than Mulholland Drive.
Like which one? Oh, yeah.
Lost Highway.
Well, I think Mulholland's got this magical quality, but Lost Highway was made to be a film and it's insular and perfect.
Absolutely.
Every element Mulholland's is expansive.
Yeah.
Well, you know what was amazing about Lost Highway was there was 1-2 week gap during the new Twin Peaks. I can't remember. I used to get together with my friends every week and we'd watch it, and there was one – they took a break for whatever it was. And I had just gotten an import Blu-ray of Lost Highway, which I hadn't seen in years. Yeah. And so we watched that instead of Twin Peaks, and I felt like we just were watching another episode of The Return. Yeah. Like, it fits so perfectly in that world, that surreal of that season.
It's so great.
It's a crazy movie.
And I'll be honest, I've never tailgated again. Never. That's my end joke for the episode for Lost Highway fans, Mr. Eddie.
I think I was getting my driver's license, and that movie helped me remember how many car lengths it takes to stop.
Never. Also, Henry Rollins tie-in. He's really good at that. That wife killer's pretty fucked up. Great line.
I remember I went to see it at the Ritz in Philly off of South Street. My dad drove me and my girlfriend because we couldn't drive ourselves, and she broke up with me after the ride home.
No.
I think we got back together later, but it was
Gary Busey will do that.
I can't believe I watched that movie. Stories, my dad was sitting behind us. It was the weirdest. Like, what were we doing? What was I thinking? Yeah. I don't know.
Did he take your arm and place it on her shoulder?
I think my dad was just like, "What did I do?"
Your dad was in a psychogenic fugue himself. He's like, "Oh no, I'm older and younger and which one am I?" Anyway, that movie is so. I still can't believe that's not on Blu-ray here. It's one of those ones where you're like, "How is that?" There's a number of films that just make no sense.
Yeah, I thought I heard a rumor that Criterion might have had it because they did Eraserhead and
Mulholland Drive. It makes total sense.
It seems inevitable.
October films, which is
I kind of want it to be a Code Red release. It's something really dirty and sinister.
Because unfortunately that import Blu-ray doesn't look great.
No.
But I still just like having it.
It's really hard. I think there is a pirated HD file that's been floating around for a long time, but I don't think even that looks that great. And it might be an up-res. Mm.
And speaking of sound design, and the only reason I bring up in that film, particularly whenever I teach sound design, and it's because it's such a good scene in the film, but even on its own, when kids have never seen anything, I show them the party scene where the mystery man walks up to him and the sound dips to nothing. And you are locked in a bubble.
Yeah.
And if you just watch this one scene, you will be blown away how sound can just change how you feel. Yeah. It's just the dread is palpable.
That was my first instance of because I would download scripts online. I remember downloading the long Fire Walk With Me script, like 300-page version from like Drew's Scriptorama back in the day.
Oh, I remember that site,
So I think at the Lost Highway, it was before the movie came out, but there were like two or three scenes that script pages that had come out. So it was that scene. And I remember reading – it was the first time and we do this all the time now in Hollywood in making movies. We read scripts before movies come out. But I read that. And then I saw that scene and it was like there's no way to describe how insanely different and how no matter what you imagine that scene's going to be like on the page, give me back my phone. Seeing Robert Blake in that fucking makeup and with the sound design is insane.
And it's the aesthetics. That's what the film movies are not scripts.
No,
even though you need a good script, but they are not the same genre or format.
If a script is perfect, there's no reason for it to be a movie. It's a good script.
Okay, good. I'm glad we got to talk about Lynch. just fit a little bit.
Do you want to talk about Jurassic now? Because I will gladly talk about
that. You can come up Pure Cinema for that one. we'll save that talk. Though I will ask you, have you ever seen his first film, which is kind of a horror film?
Which
Part of the Night?
No, I haven't seen that one.
It's his other best film.
And
a lot of people have never seen that one. And you look through all this stuff. His first film, it's actually based on true stories in World War II about his dad had to make these weird viruses. But it is so well made. It's up there with Possession.
I saw a couple years ago, BAM, and then I think CineFamily here did the retrospective. Mm-hmm. And I know at BAM, they showed a bunch of the Polish ones with live subtitles from the Polish Society. And I can't even remember the names of them, but I saw about 8 or 9 Trzaski films, but I didn't see that one. There were two I missed. I think that was one of them.
Just keep an eye. It's, for some reason, it hasn't got a good disc yet, but it's a good, really good movie. You'll love it. We'll save that for another time.
Well, Graham, thank you so much for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, Dead Wax is on in its entirety on Shudder now. Check it out and stay tuned for this vinyl release of the soundtrack.
Very soon, Death Wax.
All right, man. Cool. Thanks again.
Thanks,
guys.
Yeah.